The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Broken like the first morning, blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world.
Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow. One reason for religious gatherings is to give life to our dreams, to bolster our hope, to uplift our spirits. This time and this place is one where we look to each other to share and embolden our dreams. Dreams for a better world. Dreams for a kinder future and existence with love at the center. I am Reverend Andrew Weber, a guide here for our life journey of searching, of finding, of living our dreams. And here at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we are all seekers, we are all guides, each a minister in our own right, and each with dignity, each with worthiness. And I often say that, I often say we are all ministers doing the work of shared ministry together. And actually, I want to go further than just saying it. Yes, we're all ministers, we do shared ministry. People are like, yeah, okay, Andrew, I get it, you know, we share this. No, I have more. There's always more. I want your input. It's like if I could point to every single one of you, your input. Specifically in worship planning. When I do worship planning, it's usually me praying, running, thinking, studying, Google searching. These are all paths to the holy, paths to inspiration. And I love to have other paths there. So starting this Wednesday, on the third Wednesday, in a very brief half an hour meeting, 6:30 to 7, there'll be a link in the announcements and you can always email, text me. 6:37, final Wednesday of the month. I will still do what I usually do of looking for pieces and inspiration and topics, but I would be more than welcome, happy for anyone to join just to sign on and be like, Andrew, those music, that music you had, that was terrible. Or that music, that really moves me. Or here's something that I read and I really think would work well. You are all invited. That is more of our shared ministry. So whether you have specific ideas or not, you are welcome, and there is no commitment there. The flaming chalice is a symbol of our growing and evolving faith. The spark calling to mind a spark of creativity in each of our souls. Also, a remembrance of the fires which have burned books, which have ended stories and ended lives. This flame helps us remember the wonderful, the terrible past, which we are a product of. The flame also points a way forward into an unknown future, which we can help create. I have, as I usually do in the morning, asked someone to come light the chalice, and today I based it purely on outfit. Corinne, can you please come forward to light our chalice? And as she lights the chalice, I will read these words from Reverend Dr. David Breeden. Not to make anyone feel old, but Jaws turned 50 this year. And it's playing a lot of places because of that anniversary. Okay, Corinne, please. We tender this flame, opening the book, turning to a page yet to be written, opening a story yet to be told. May we fill this fresh page wisely. May we write a new story into being. May we together inscribe the page with hope. And as we do each Sunday, we light a second flame, a beacon of wishful thinking, a beacon of what we want to make in the world for peace. Please respond with the words on the screen. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world. Thank you. Our opening hymn is From You I Receive. It is 402 in the gray hymnal. They're in the back if you want one. Also, the lyrics will be on the screen. I invite you to rise in body or in spirit to sing From You I Receive. I have a story for you today. Sometimes I bring a video, sometimes a book. Today I'm going to speak the story and maybe ask for some input too, if people know this. Who knows the story of the brave little tailor? Jerry raised his hand, more than just Jerry. Okay, yeah. Some people have, yes, we know this. The Brave Little Tailor is a tale that was gathered by the Grimm brothers, Grimm's fairy tales, but oral tradition hundreds of years before that, okay? And it's been rewritten and retold by many, many people over the years with just as many differences in their tellings. For me, when I think of the brave little tailor, I remember those little red viewfinder things that you click with these pictures of Mickey Mouse. That's what I think of. It's like, oh, there he is with the giant. Oh, click. Oh, yeah. Oh, where's the next little round thing? I got them out of order. Right? That's my memory. You may have a different one of this, the brave little tailor. What happens first, if people know this story? What's the very first thing? There's a tailor who's sewing. He gets hungry. So what does he do? He makes himself some food, bread and jam is, I think, the classic. He puts some jam on. And what happens in the summertime when you have jam laying out? Some flies come. Yeah, oh my gosh, they're pests. Flies or bees or something. And so the tailor gets his fly swatter. And I'm saying he a lot because I'm thinking Mickey Mouse. If the gender is confusing, you can always switch that. It doesn't matter that it's a he. But he gets his fly swatter and he goes, whack. And he's like, I got 7 flies with one blow. Yeah, right, I'd be proud of that. Yeah, 7 flies with one blow, that's hard to do if all those flies are flying around. I mean, I hope he didn't hit him on his food, but he got 7 flies. And so what does he do? Well, being a tailor, he makes himself a belt that's like 7 with one blow. If you know that, like the WWE, like wrestling, like one of those, like, right? 7 flies with one blow, or 7 with one blow. And he goes around and he tells his neighbors, because he's proud. He's like, I did this cool thing. I got 7 with one blow. And they think, 7 people? Like 7 burglars? Some of them might think, 7 ogres? Like, wow, this tailor's really something. And so he tells up people and they tell other people and the story sort of grows out of proportion. And it gets to the king. There's a king in the story. And the king, his city or his kingdom is being harassed by a giant. right? That also happens a lot in these stories. And he's like, well, we don't know what to do about the giant, but this tailor, he defeated 7 people with 1 blow. I should call on him to take care of the giant. So he calls on Mickey, on the tailor, on the brave little tailor. He says, can you take care of this giant? And he's like, oh, but that's not, yes, great, okay. Go, take care of the giant, get rid of him. All right, and what happens? In some stories, the tailor tricks the giant by squeezing cheese instead of a stone or doing things that sort of outwitting them. In Mickey Mouse, he actually sews him up and his hand is like caught in his shirt and he twists around with, if you want to look, it's online. You can watch that and see some of my childhood and maybe yours too. It didn't quite fit with service to play it. Didn't quite fit. But he defeats the giant. He's the hero. And at the end, everyone's saying, wow, this amazing tailor, the seamstress, the person who mends our clothes, defeated this giant. And the reason I'm sharing this is he, at the very end, this is when it says the little brave tailor. Do you think this tailor was brave at the very beginning?
No.
There's some no. He just wanted to get the flies. He just wanted to get the flies off his jam. He's like, I just want my jam sandwich. I was hungry. What about at the end? He defeated a giant. It's like he's probably a little proud of himself. He's brave maybe then. He had pride in the middle. What changed between the beginning and the end? Perception. Belief of others. Yeah, his perception, not only his, but other people's perceptions of him. The spirit?
Lived experience.
Lived experience, yes. Lived experience. Yeah. Right? Do you think this is a factual story? Was there someone sewing who, yes, who actually swatted flies, okay, believable, and then defeated a giant? Less believable. So maybe not factually happened, but was there someone, or can you think of a time in your life when you're like, wow, I don't know if I can do this really difficult thing, but I did this small thing. Like I completed the crossword this morning in the paper, right? Which for some of us is a big thing. For some of us, it's a small thing. It's like, so maybe I can reach out and call that friend who I've had a hard time dealing with, or maybe I can go to the DMV, which sometimes is a hard thing. Like we can build on our lived experiences, on our bravery, on our past. So what do you think? Does completing something easy ever help you with something more difficult? Sure. Yeah.
It gives you confidence.
It gives you confidence. Yeah. Today I'm going back and forth with story, with song, with sort of reflecting on things. So just so you know what's happening. That was our story. And I encourage you to continue listening, continue to thinking about the brave little tailor, and maybe think about things in your life that are helped you gain confidence, but also the tailor that wasn't factually true, but maybe had some truth to be in it. It's not unique, right? This story is not unique in its use of allegory. I could have used illustrations from all over any topic today, right? I mean, think of a mythological or a fanciful tale. Brothers Grimm, all of the fairy tales pretty much are fanciful or mythological. Disney movies, which I guess now includes Marvel movies, right? You can look at those. DC, if you want to go that. You know, those are all fanciful. Fantastic. I hope I'm not bursting anyone's bubbles. These are not true stories, right? Holy texts, such as Christian Bible, right? Jewish Torah, Hindu Upanishads, Aesop's fables, right? Oral folk tales, and even stories passed down or told in families, right? You might have some oral history in your family, like, oh, remember when we did that amazing climb up the mountain? It's like, yeah. It was not maybe not a mountain. It was like a walk for our family, right? Right? And there's no reason to stop there, right? A list of fanciful tales can span the library. I mean, you can ask the librarians, like, exactly how far could it span? Well, you get the fiction, mythology, spirituality, science fiction, mystery. I mean, you can keep listing them, of the tales that are not true. And the one thing that all these stories have in common is that they're not facts as historians or as journalists try to capture. So when I read a fairy tale about a tailor beating a giant, or watch a movie about a woman, for example, who can shoot ice from her hands, just as an example, I know that these events didn't actually happen. Like, that didn't take place. Elsa doesn't shoot ice from her hands and create winter in Arendelle. Just as when I hear about Jesus healing a leper, or how a fox gave up trying to eat grapes because they were out of reach, I know that these aren't factual accounts of historical events. Okay, you're with me, right? Fiction isn't fact, right? That's the definition of fiction, right? It isn't fact. So I'm not going to belabor that. The amazing part, though, the part that we sometimes miss, is that there's truth to be had in myth. There's truth in that. Even in fiction and stories and fairy tales, the reason that some of these tales have so much power, they get retold, right? Frozen is not the original. That might be bursting people's bubbles. Like, a lot of these stories are like retold and retold. That's not the original story. They have so much power, and they keep getting told and retold, is because they have truth in them. Truth that isn't despite the fiction, but sometimes the truth that's deeper, that's more emotional. It's heightened by the mythology. Some say that mythological thinking, sort of like the prehistoric way of thinking. I've heard this. It's like, yeah, it explained what we couldn't explain at the time, what our ancestor could not explain, right? And now we have science. Now we have modern thinking. We have problem solving. So I don't need that, right? The view holds that Aesop's fables and a lot of religious texts only existed to explain a world which was, at the time of writing, unexplainable. And so now we're in a fact-filled reality. We don't need those stories, right? I mean, that's what a lot of people say, and that's what sometimes we think, and our culture says that too. And this is the difference I'm talking about. Mythos is a way of thinking. It's a Greek term for the truth from myths, and logos, which is more factual-based. And so I'm going to use those terms too. But there are truths that facts cannot speak to. Right, so I can look at logos when I'm creating vaccines, when I'm building an airplane, much of mathematics, but there's a whole area of life where logos, where fact falls short, right? Science tells me I am born, I live, and I will die. That's pretty scientific. Those are sort of facts. Like, okay, I am born, I will live, I will die. That's all of us. But it doesn't say anything about falling in love, about being heartbroken, about what it means to die. Right? Logos has nothing to say about the meaning of life. You can't do a scientific study about the meaning of life. Logos can express the contents of a cool glass of iced tea, or can express the contents of that warm mug of coffee early in the morning, but only mythos can describe how drinking that makes us feel, right? Mythos is a language of truth that goes beyond facts, beyond the facts. Mythos goes beyond the facts. So I'm going to look at some other well-known tales from the brave tailor. Like, how did it feel to achieve something you're proud of, right? How does it feel? How does that feeling help you tackle something more difficult? This story explains self-confidence better than saying, here are some facts about it. Right? In the Bible, Jesus may not have literally placed hands on people to heal them, but he brought calm, he brought peace, he brought a sense of love to distraught people. Right? Aesop's fables, a fox didn't actually try to get grapes and then say, well, I can't get the grapes, you know, I should do something else, I changed my mind about my desire, but there's that truth of unmet expectations and how we can either be upset or change our expectations when we do or do not get what we have. Right? Now, this is, I think this is religion also. This is religion at its finest, at its most confusing. Because every religion, we describe God, for example, by example, right? God is always metaphor. And that's what mythological truth. But the problem is when we take one and conflate it with the other. And I'll get more into that later. For right now, I want to say we can think of these tales from the ancient past, written or spoken eons ago, still shaping our understanding of the world. And each tale can have different meanings. Some of them shift and some of them have different meanings over time. You might think of the little tailor and be like, oh, that has this meaning. Someone else may, it's about confidence. No, it's about people's perception. No, it's about gender roles. No, it's about what is a giant and what's good and bad in the world, right? And the next illustration I'm gonna give you is a song. And it's about the reality of growing up, of aging, and I think all the more meaningful because its author, Peter Yarrow, passed away earlier this year in January. It's Puff the Magic Dragon. And there are different interpretations of Puff the Magic Dragon. There's the intended one. There's one that other people took from it. And they are just as powerful and just as real and just as meaningful. So feel free to sing along with the chorus, if you know the words. Feel free to just let it wash over you. This is a recording from 1986.
Seems you know that little ditty. Once upon a time, a long time ago, in a far-off land by the sea, there lived a much maligned dragon. Don't you know that it was really a pity, because there never was a different meaning other than the obvious one. But the magic dragon is only about the loss of innocence of children. And now you can tell your friends that you've heard it from the dragon's father's mouth. And another thing you'll notice, that we're singing this song earlier in the program than we ever sang it before. That's because many of the children who used to come, who were very young, would fall asleep before it was possible for them to hear. So all that goes to show is that even after 25 years, a group like us can still learn something new. Sing it with me now. Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Annalee. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings, sealing wax, and other fancy stuff. Sing it out, little Puff. The magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Annalee. Oh, Puff, the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Annalee.
And together they would travel on a boat with billowed sail. Jackie kept a lookout perched on Puff's gigantic tail.
Noble kings and princes would bow whene'er they came. Pirate ships would lower their flags when Puff roared out his name. Hi, I'm Puff. Make way for other toys. One gray night
Now, I could tell you that children grow up and change how they play, right? But a song about a lonely dragon who no longer has a small child to play with illustrates it much better than I can. It speaks more truth than just factual words about, oh yeah, kids grow up. Middle school starts tomorrow. Oh my gosh. Whew, I need a moment. Not for me, for my son. Although I don't want middle school again either, so. Right, Jackie Paper created Puff the Dragon and played with Puff. There's truth past mere facts and numbers, a reality only witnessed to through allegory. And here's a simplified, because we're talking about like listening to both types of truth, the mythos truth that we saw in this song, that we saw in the story, the logos truth of fact and figures. Here's a simplified example of listening to both sides of this truth. I have, a couple years now, I've had the opportunity to speak with a senior high school in Newark, Delaware, and there's a class on rhetoric, and I spoke to them about the life of Pi, and because the professor and I, we run a lot together, and he's like, hey, you're a minister, can you talk with these guys about the life of Pi, because it brings up some religious stuff. I was like, yes, I'd love to. And so we talked about the life of Pi, and in that story, there are two competing truths, or possibly more competing truths, if you've seen the movie or read the book, right? The both truths are about a boy on a raft, one where he was trapped with zoo animals, and one where he shares the raft with humans. And in the story, we're not really sure which one is like true, which one is the fact or not. So we're exploring the topic in this high school class of which one is the better story, which one is the better truth, and did truth come into play with which one was better, and was there truth to be held even if the events never took place, even if neither of these took place, was there truth there? These are the same questions we're having. And my time in the classroom happens to be around the time of prom. It's just happens to be prom. And so I asked them, in order to give them an example of mythos and logos, I said, in science versus emotion, I said, describe to me your experiences of prom. And first, I wanted a description with only facts and data, no feelings, just facts. And so I heard how much outfits cost, which is a lot. I heard what music was playing. I heard what time the event stopped, what time the event started, how many people were there, right? These are the facts. They're all true. They're all fact. And that sort of thing. And then I asked for a description of prom. I said, tell me about your experiences of prom, but only tell me emotions. Only tell me feelings, no facts. Well, there are a lot of feelings at prom. So I didn't have to ask for much, right? There are highs, there are lows. Oh my gosh, there's love, there's betrayal, there's confusion, there's excitement, there's sadness. And you know what? Every one of those descriptions held truth. No facts. It was mythos, not logos, and it was still true. It was true that there was excitement and joy. It was true that the dresses were expensive. They're not competing truths, they're complementary. And not only are they complementary, but the sort of unprovable, the more emotional truths are the deeper ones, which definitely will be held and will be remembered long after the factual ones fade. Like, I don't know what time my prom started. Yeah, I remember what I felt when I was there, right? And coming back to this community, we can think about deep discussions around faith, around social justice, around political concerns. Oh, I think there are a lot of political concerns, right? And so often disagreements are not about the facts, not only about truth, but also about the type of truth we are listening to, right? We aren't even discussing the same thing sometimes. My faith in the goodness of humanity can't be dissuaded by facts. It's been challenged. It continues to be challenged by facts, but I still have faith in the goodness of humanity. Your belief in the divinity of all, for example, can't be unproven through experiment, through reason. Right? The whole evolution creation debate is a conflation of mythos and logos. Mythos tells that there is a mystery in the creation of life. We don't know where life comes from. Oh my gosh, how are we a conscience? How can we look at ourselves and say, me, you, us? What is happening there? That can be disproved by data. And logos tell us that there's an ongoing changing of one life form into another, of one creature into another, which can't be disproved with emotion. You say, but I feel that humans were created in the image of God. I say, well, that doesn't disprove the data we see. We're competing two different types of truth that cannot talk to each other. That's the problem when we conflate, because they don't necessarily conflict with each other, except for they're taking mythos as fact and we're taking logos as emotion. And the point is that, I mean, my point for you here, one of the points is that we don't discount either type of truth. And we also don't try to equate them. The Bible is full of truth as mythos. And some logos sprinkled in, right? There's some fact. A nonfiction history book is full of truth as logos, as factual things, with some mythos sprinkled in, right? It's wise for us to not ignore one or other type of truth and to not conflate the two. It can be easily thrown out an entire story. It's so easy to throw out an entire story. We'd say, well, it's not true. Say, that's not true. Throw it out. It's like, well, we miss all the deeper meanings there, the truth and fantasy. And it's especially important to listen to truths in mythos when looking at religious text, and even more so when speaking with other people on matters of faith, on matters of politics, right? If I read the Upanishads or the Bible with only an interest in factual, what actually happened, historical events, I'm going to miss the vast majority of the truth to be had. And if I conflate the truths in those texts with facts, I miss the truths and get confused about fact and fiction, myth and logos. Here's another hymn for us. And I want you to listen to this hymn. It's not one that we sing often because it's a little quirky, but it's fun because it has the words that specifically speak to the scientific and the spiritual reality of our existence. It's 343, A Fire Mist and a Planet. You may rise in body or in spirit. 343, A Fire Mist and a Planet.
A fire mist and a planet, a crystal and a cell, a starfish and a saurian, and caves where ancients dwelt. The sense of law and beauty, a face turned from the sod, some call it evolution, and others call it God.
Haze on the far horizon, the infinite tender sky, the ripe rich tents of and wild geese sailing high, and over high and lowland, the charm of golden rod, some people call it autumn, and others call it God. Like tides on crescent sea beach, when moons so blue and thin, into our hearts I
quirky, a little strange, but speak some truth there. I have a couple readings, and I'm going to talk a little bit more, and and then we'll move on with more singing. And I picked two readings here on purpose from two books that sort of are talking about the same thing, but in a different level of approachability. So Dan Brown, sort of like written for the every person, very approachable, easy to read, fun reads. Salman Rushdie is much denser, just as he writes. He's a much denser writer, but very similar in what they're saying. From Dan Brown, Sophie, every faith in the world is based on fabrication. That is the definition of faith, acceptance of that which we imagine to be true, that which we cannot prove. Every religion describes God through metaphor, allegory, and exaggeration, from the early Egyptians through modern Sunday school. Metaphors are a way to help our minds process the unprocessable. The problems arise when we begin to believe literally in our own metaphors. And from Salman Rushdie. This is a story from our past, from a time so remote that we argue sometimes about whether we should call it history or mythology. Some of us call it a fairy tale. But on this, we agree that to tell a story about the past is to tell a story about the future. To recount a fantasy, a story of the imaginary, is also a way of recounting a tale of the actual. If this were not true, then the deed would be pointless, and we would try in our daily lives to eschew pointlessness whenever possible. This is the question we ask ourselves as we explore and narrate our history. How did we get here from there? Wow, yeah. In matters of faith, I say, in matters of faith, in matters of all things, really, it's helpful when we talk to remember this distinction between mythos and logos. So when someone is coming from a place of emotion and feelings, if you can imagine you or someone you love coming from a place of emotion and feelings, or someone that you don't love, responding with facts and figures is less than helpful. I mean, not just less than helpful. That's a nice way of saying, like, if you're emotional and someone's like, but have you discovered, like, this path we have? So it's like, I don't need facts and figures. I need emotions. I need support. I need you to hear me. The opposite also true. If we respond with emotions and feelings to someone who's talking about facts, we are talking past each other. It's not, we're not going to meet. We're not going to have anything sort of to talk about. Arguing facts against emotions will never end well, right? And from Salman Rushdie, when he talks about the questions, this is the question we ask, is how did we get here from there? When we tell a story about our past, we're telling a story about our present, and our telling is shaping our present, it's shaping our future, right? We create the present and future. I've talked about this a little bit. It's like, we can create it. We have that power. Even our narration, even in our storytelling, right? Think about George Orwell's famous book, 1984, right? Slip of the tongue. No. His famous book of 1984, where the past was recreated. You just have to rewrite what happened, and that becomes truth. Now we see some of that happening today. Is the past mutable? Can we change what happened? That's a big topic, right? I mean, because whatever we want to be true, if you want to see what the past is, who writes the past? Is it, well, the people in charge, the people who have, of wars, the victor of history, the people who are still there? Is that true? I mean, there is truth to be had. Is it factual accounting of what exactly happened? I don't know. Maybe not, right? That's the saying, that history is written by the victors, and whoever has the power can do that. And I find that unsettling to say that the past can change, that it's mutable, but I get it. I mean, look at Thanksgiving for an example. And we had a service last year about Thanksgiving, about Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day. The way we view those two, three holidays is shifting, is changing. Thanksgiving, when I was a kid, I made construction paper feathers or a pilgrim hat. Ooh, I don't think they do that anymore. Because we talk more about, oh, this wasn't a positive experience for everyone. We're not sure, but it doesn't look like it was positive for everyone. Columbus Day with Columbus, you know, he came here and he found America. Well, yeah, no, he didn't, right? He came here and he brought disease and weapons and a sense of privilege. Wow, yeah. So the past is, our understanding of the past is changing. Here's a quote from the end, near the end of The Life of Pi, where the boy is being asked about what actually happened. This is the very end when they're saying, but Pi, what actually happened? Mr. Okamoto, but for the purposes of our investigation, we would like to know what really happened. What really happened? Yes. So you want another story? No, we would like to know what really happened. Doesn't the telling of something always become a story? Perhaps in English. In Japanese, a story would have an element of invention in it. We don't want any invention. We want the straight facts, as you say in English. Isn't telling about something, using words, English or Japanese, already something of an invention? Isn't just looking upon this world already something of an invention? The world isn't just the way it is. It is how we understand it, no? And in understanding something, we bring something to it, no? Doesn't that make life a story? Right? So maybe past events as they took place aren't mutable, but how we understand the past, how we know it, certainly, those are mutable. We have powers in this myth of history, the power of telling stories, of historical fact, semi-historical tales. We can't help but we do it, right? We can't help but tell stories, both factual, historical, mythological, fanciful. And who tells the story? What words are used? What is remembered? What is forgotten? That's how, by speaking, we create our past. We create our reality. We create our future, right? And the reason I picked the Brave Little Tailor, it's a little bit meta in its construction. I really like doing that. Like, here's the example. And then, like, here's the example, too, right? Because not only does it speak mythos to the truth of the accomplishment of feeling brave, but if we look at it, the tailor tells a story himself, which then comes true. He wasn't especially brave at the beginning, but by the end, he's ready to take on this unimaginable task of defeating a giant. So he told himself he was brave. He believed himself brave. Others believed him to be brave. And then he became brave. Like, whoa, yeah, that's the meta of what we're doing, of what we're talking about. And we can do that in our communal stories. Look at our country. There's so many examples of how things are framed, of how things are talked about. I mean, how gatherings are explained, Black Lives Matter protest versus insurrection at the Capitol, right? How those are framed. People protesting, people rioting, mobs, thugs. The media, our politicians, they know the power of words. They choose words to make us think one thing or another, right? They put things in a positive lens, things that they want positive. They put things in the negative lens that they want negative. That's creating the reality there. The words which we use, right? A group described as a mob of thugs will be remembered as a mob of thugs. A group described as patriotic protesters will be remembered as patriotic protesters, unless that narrative changes. Thankfully, the media and some politicians are beginning to see that power and say, oh, maybe we need to be more open. Not everyone, but some are saying we need to make sure we're aware of what we're saying. And it's true personally, right? We take part in creating the reality, our reality, others' reality. If I keep telling someone that they're not worthy, they're going to start to believe that they're not worthy. They will act it, they'll embody that sense in themselves, they'll embody it. If, on the other hand, and I hope you hear this, you are worthy of love. You are beloved. I say it a lot. Oh my gosh, is he saying that again? This is part of the reason, because I say it, and eventually one day I'm like, I know Andrew says that, but like, I'm worthy of love. I might start living differently, thinking, I'm worthy of love. I'm worthy of love, yes. you're worthy of love, right? That's that power we speak to, right? If I continually tell someone that you're powerful, you are beautiful, you're strong, you're loved, you will act more into that. You'll help create that reality. When we talk about each other, when we talk about ourselves, when we talk about what is happening in the world, we're using that truth of mythos, that truth of logos, creating that truth of mythos. So all of this, the point of all of this is twofold. If you were sleeping the whole time, this is when you wake up and like, okay, great, okay, this is what Andrew's talking about. First is listen to truth from both facts and myth. Myth often holds a truth more powerful and deeper than factual accounts, especially for our culture and for our religion sometimes. Don't discount mythology as lacking truth. The corollary is to be open to others' truths and what might be there. And also, be very careful of conflating mythos and logos, myth and fact, in either direction. That conflation is very dangerous. That's your first. That's a big one. Okay, now second is we all tell stories. We all create reality with our myths, with our stories that we tell. Our past, our present, our future can all be changed through how we remember, through how we construct our truths, through how we tell our stories. So be careful. Be careful when which reality you are creating. And use your power of storytelling, use your power of myth telling, your power of creation for good. So listen to both truths and be careful which truth you create. Myths speak to a deeper truth than facts, speaking to the truth of the soul. Hear that truth of the soul. And when you create that truth of the soul, for you do, do so in a loving way. Amen. I'm going to sit down. Part of me wanting to share ministry is also matters of the heart. And you've seen over the past months, almost a year now, we have members of the care team come up to introduce matters of the heart. Our care team is really an extension of my pastoral care ministry. It's again this shared ministry of saying, it's not just me. If you're having an emotional time, a high or a low that you want to talk with someone, of course, yes, reach out to me. You can also reach out to other people. The care team is in specific contact with me just so we can support each other. Of course, reach out to friends, reach out to people who aren't on the care team. Oh my gosh, yes. Therapists, they're wonderful. Love them. But each Sunday we take a moment where we share something. This might even be where we share our mythos. We share our emotional truths, those highs, those lows, which pour out, which must be shared, that they are heightened or that they are lessened. So if you have something in your life which must be shared with this community, please come forward. I never know where to put the mic on the ground or up here. If you need to move it, you can just move it. Come forward and speak into the microphone. If you're online, you can raise your virtual or your physical hand to be unmuted. And please start with your name.
Bring this time of sharing to a close. Thank you to all. And as we often do, we will bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. The words will show up on the screen.
Spirit of life, earth and sea and sky, place of deep longing in my heart, find your way from silence to voice. Give me strength and courage to speak truth through my life, for I am a creature of the universe, small but infinite, a momentary body in the sea of life and also the sea itself. I am a gathered bit of energy, and one who gathers, a creation and a creator. Let me not hold too tightly to one form and lose the other, for we are not form, but process, ever changing and ever renewing. Help us see that we are neither the beginning nor the end, but something perfectly natural and imperfectly divine. Amen. Please join with me in our closing hymn, number 301, Touch the Earth, Reach the Sky. You may rise in body or in spirit.
Touch the earth, reach the sky, walk on shores while spirits fly, over the ocean, over the land, our faith a quest to understand. Touch the earth, reach the sky, children ask the reasons why. In our lives the answers show, and by our love they learn and grow. Touch the earth, reach the sky, all are born and all shall die. Lies the time left in between to follow a star, to build a dream. Touch the earth, reach the sky, hug the laughter, feel the cry. May we see where we can give, for this is what it means to live. Touch the earth, reach the sky, soar with courage ever high, spirits joining as we fly, to touch the earth, to reach the sky.
May the stories we tell name the largest truths of what was, of what is, and pull us forward to what should be, as stories were always meant to. Amen and blessed be.